one of the things that didn't do on Monday was demonstrate a bit more of a complex calculation involving the Cartan formalism. But given it's sort of just essentially a calculation, it's not a sort of conceptual step through, although I think it's very useful to see how it works. I decided that anticipating a bunch of questions, just going through a calculation, it would be better to just give a handout of the calculation so that you can follow it through. In addition, I think the particular handout also talks about using killing vectors to sort of reduce the number of explicit degrees of freedom in the metric. So if you have a spherically symmetric metric, so if you have an SO3 symmetry, in other words, you have a set of killing vectors which satisfy an SO3 algebra, then you can prove that you can split the metric into something times this unit two-sphere metric. In general, you would have a function here, and then you would just have another function sort of in front of a combination of some time and some space-like coordinate. But if in addition you have a time-like killing vector, an additional killing vector, then you can also peel off the fact that you can choose coordinates that look like this. Now I could still, sorry, that should be c squared, not r squared. I can still reduce this metric further because I could choose c equals r. But for the purpose of the calculation, I was just keeping it separate. So as I say, it's not important that you don't have the handout at the moment because it is a procedural thing. It's going walking you through the calculation. So hopefully you'll get it soon and then you can just go through it in your own time and see how the Cartan works. And in particular, see how much briefer and more compact and much easier process it is for calculating the Riemann tensor, okay? So at the end of the story, what you get is you get a set of components for the Ricci tensor, which is what we need for Einstein's equations. If you can't read my writing, just say, because I'm getting tired at the end. And you see that the spherical symmetry here kind of feeds into a sort of symmetry in the Ricci, that the angular components here are just the same, okay? So now what I want to talk about today, and I know you'll have seen some of this before, but what I wanted to talk about was black hole solutions. So first of all, we'll just sort of derive again the simple black hole, the Schwarzschild black hole. Then I want to talk about it from the perspective of causal structure. So we'll do like Penrose diagrams and coordinate transformations. And then I'll talk about what happens with a cosmological constant. Okay. So I'll just make a comment there about so, for example, if I set b equal to 1, then my r coordinate would be proper distance, proper radial distance. So that's one thing I could do. Also note that for c, keeping c, so again, you have to if in Einstein gravity, this would involve violating an energy condition, but this, if you keep this C of R, you could imagine C decreases as R decreases, but then it reaches a stationary point and maybe starts increasing as you keep going in. And that is a sort of wormhole type of throat. So there are some solutions where you start looking at string-derived gravity where you might actually have this happening. And then the most common gauge is C equals R, which is the area gauge, because the area of two spheres is 4 pi r squared. Okay? So that's sort of the most common gauge. So typically you see C as R, and then you think, you know, that has an intuitive meaning, but then you have to remember that radial coordinate is not a proper distance. So let's take this area gauge. So I'm first just going to write down what the TT component is of the Einstein equation, because I just wrote Ricci here rather than Einstein. And then I'm going to solve this. So let me just write. Yeah.
I was wondering, you're saying gauges, but do these correspond to different physical states?
No, that's why they're gauge.
Oh,
gauge is just coordinates in GR.
What do you quite mean then by, like, if here keeping C allows a wormhole like solution? So
I mean, for example, I could choose, e.g., B is 1 over A, right? So I could restrict by saying B was 1 over A, but then I couldn't take C equals R in general.
But does keeping C correspond to a different, like, physical state where you have...
No, I'm just trying to draw attention to the fact that having a function C there allows, you know, for different types of solution. Now, if you have GR with normal matter, you know, or semi-exotic but still normal matter, then you see that C can't actually have a turning point in Einstein gravity. But if you have a different sort of gravity, scalar tensor, or some more exotic matter present, then you can have a solution where C does have a turning point.
What does the turning point correspond to?
A wormhole throat, because C gets smaller as you go in. And then it has this stationary point, but then as you keep going in, it's getting bigger. Mm-hmm. So that is the definition of a wormhole.
Okay, so that's just a comment there, but the other...
It's a comment, yeah. So this is a gauge. I mean, I could say B is 1 over A, but I keep C in, but it's a comment, yeah. So if I take the area gauge, my GTT, I can write actually in a very convenient form. So this tells me that the way in which that radial function changes is related to the local energy density. This is not linearized gravity. This is an exact result. It's the interpretation that becomes more linearized. So this is my answer, or general answer, for the radial potential in the metric. Now we're tempted to interpret this thing here.
Why is the first term 1?
Because I've multiplied by r squared.
No. After you're integrating afterwards.
Because it's r on b squared. So I integrate 1, I get r, but then I divide by r again.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah.
What's the initial condition of that integral?
That's what I'm saying, it's just, it's in general. So, roll with it. For the moment. So I'm just saying this is true in terms of, you know, this is my differential equation. So I guess I'm integrating it. If I do the r, right, that would be integrating it from 0 to r. I might want to integrate it from somewhere else. I'm being non-specific at the moment because what I'm trying to do is just derive the general expression, okay?
But the moment you put 1 there, it's not as general as you want it, because you have the lower value of 0.
Yeah, but this is really low-level maths. This is not looking at the conceptual part. If you want me to be accurate, I'll put in a constant. So, you know, this is not important. So,
I ask some other question?
Yeah.
So here for observation, we use the area.
Yes, I'm using the area gauge, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then this r is not really the radial distance now.
I know, that's why I said it's sort of in inverted commas. So I'm saying that's why I was sort of putting it sort of in inverted commas. But when we see this, this sort of has a very intuitive meaning to us. So then we come back to the question about, come on, make it stop being so impressionistic, try and be more precise, right? And now I'm going to kind of come back to that point, which is that if I'm in linearized gravity, so I've just got a very weak T naught naught, I can integrate from the origin, right? And so that would mean that from a sort of flat space perspective, that really would be the energy inside a radius R. So that is how we actually find the 8 pi g in Einstein equations. So, but I'm saying that, again, impressionistic, because I'm interested in pulling out the essence. That I can certainly write, but m, you know, that depends on what m is. So for linearized gravity, this gives us the 8 pi g factor in the Einstein equations. If I was integrating in general, so going back to the question, then I would still say I had my 1, but my constant, or rather in terms of that, strictly speaking, my constant, I would then just say, is an integration constant, which is what m is. Okay, so let me now look at a vacuum solution. And let me look at GTT minus GRR. So if I look at, that's the same as RTT minus RRR. A double primes cancel. C double prime to zero if C is R. Minus A prime B prime cancels. And so all I'm left with is the 2 C prime on C, which is 2 on R. And then it's A primed on A plus B primed on B. And so I get my Schwarzschild solution. I have an integration constant. I have that my A is related to B. And so I have a one parameter family of solutions. And so, unknown. So you will have met this, of course, as the Schwarzschild metric. Now,
what do we mean by that statement in vacuum M is an integration constant? Can you?
So, well, it was actually coming back to the question which I was sort of, you know, leaving until I wanted to, you know, to actually talk about the general solution. In vacuum, there's no T naught naught, right? So when we integrate up that equation R over B squared primed equals 1, when I integrate that up, I just get R plus a constant, yeah? Yeah. So it's that C term inside the bracket. But because of the intuition from weak field gravity, we're sort of interpreting this as a mass function because that's what it looks like to us, right? It's integrating an energy up across a volume. Of course, it isn't that once things are sort of very strongly gravitating, but certainly in weak gravity, that's what it is, and that really is M. That's why we label it as M. So, I don't know, I can't emphasize enough just what an amazing solution this is. I mean, Schwarzschild derived this while he was kind of in the trenches, I think, in the First World War, which is, I don't know, that impresses me anyway. But the other reason it impresses me is so often in physics, we're making compromises. We're saying that we're ignoring this detail or that detail. And so, you know, what we have is only an approximation, a very good one, to be sure, but it's only an approximation of what's going on. So the pendulum's an example. You know, we kind of linearize our motion for the pendulum, and then we get simple harmonic motion. But of course, that's not quite accurate because the bigger the amplitude of the swing of the pendulum, we get corrections. Now, in that case, we can solve mathematically, but, you know, that's the sort of principle. Here, we're talking about a solution where this is incredibly strong gravity when we get close to 2gm. I mean, this is just way beyond our direct experience. And yet this off-the-shelf solution, well, I mean, strictly speaking, it's a rotating one, but this off-the-shelf solution really, it does seem to be exactly what's happening near the event horizon of a black hole. So because gravity is such a weak force, even if the black hole is accreting, that has an almost negligible effect on the local geometry. So, you know, if you think about all the systems that we try to describe, you know, this one is just so representative of the actual object out there. You know, it's really, I always think it's quite amazing anyway. So, I mean, just think of the weather, for example, you know. Okay, so now I just want to bring out some of the, you know, the features of the black hole, and in particular causal structure, because that is, in a sense, what defines the black hole for us. So as you are no doubt well aware, R equals 2gm is not a physical singularity. So we see this by changing coordinates. So you've probably met this tortoise coordinate. And what this coordinate does is it's really telling you what is the radial coordinate that waves, so in other words, massless particles see as they get near the event horizon. So what this does is it turns dr squared divided by 1 minus 2gm on r to dr star squared times 1 minus 2gm on r. So there's this common factor here, which you pull out. And so dt minus dr star and dt plus dr star end up being the null directions in your metric, the null radial directions. So I'm guessing you've probably seen this before. Can I just check? So I know, yeah, okay, so I can kind of gallop through it a little bit.
Wait, sorry, Ruth.
Yeah.
Going back a bit, I'm not sure what you meant by, so in vacuum, a squared times 1 over
B. It's proportional to.
Oh,
oh gosh, yes. That. Yeah,
okay.
The chalk, obviously. Yeah.
Sorry.
And so then we get our constant, we get the equals because we say that as we go to infinity, we match our t coordinate with the time of an observer at infinity. Mm-hmm. So that's usually, you know, quite often we can derive a metric up to maybe a constant, and then we have to decide how do we finish the job. And in this case, what we say is, well, suppose, you know, we sort of think of ourselves, if I was looking at a black hole, I'm effectively at infinity, so my time is what I want that T to attend to, right?
Sorry, Mask, what do you mean by saying for weak fields, this gives 8 pi j in Einstein equation?
So when Einstein first derived general relativity, so he first of all probably, I'm trying to remember the story now, he first of all probably got Ricci, but then knowing that, you know, you have to sort of match up the geometry to the matter content, he was kind of looking at, well, you know, Newtonian physics, you kind of just got energy that's gravitating because, you know, relative to, you know, rest mass energy is so big. And so, you know, that's hence looking at the T naught naught part. Then you have to sort of say, well, what is this energy momentum equal to? And because you have the conservation of energy momentum, you have to have a conservation of the geometry thing on the other side. And that's how we got the Einstein tensor. And then you look at what T naught naught is equal to. And then that should reduce to a sort of Newtonian potential equation. And so it was in doing that. Now here, rather than looking at the potential equation, the derivative, you know, the differential equation, that I'm looking at the integrated version of it. So here I'm saying, what is the gravitational field away from some lump of matter? And it's this thing at the top. And from a Newtonian perspective, I would expect that to be 2gm on r. So that's where the 8 pi g comes from. You can either view it as looking at the differential equation and expecting to see the Poisson equation, Newtonian Poisson equation, or here, I've done it from a slightly different route, but just as legitimate. If I was playing ignorant, I wouldn't put 8 pi g, I'd put k, some constant. And then I would see when I got there, I need k to be 8 pi g in order to get what I know is my, you know, Newtonian gravitational potential. Okay, so what you then do effectively to get the Kruskals, what you're doing is noticing that the thing multiplying dt squared minus dr star squared is 1 minus 2 gm on r, which is basically the exponent of r star. And so you can't, that sort of gives you the clue that you're looking to exponentiate the null coordinates. And so this is what the Kruskals actually are. And then you can see that the u is u dt minus dr star, essentially, over 2r plus. And dv is v dt plus dr star over 2r plus. So that tells me that dt squared minus dr star squared is du dv over minus uv times 4r plus squared. But then I look at uv, so if I take uv here, then uv when I multiply the two together, the t's cancel out and the exponent and I'm just left with the exponential of R star. And so I can see that that's going to give me one minus, essentially one minus two GM on R. So what you end up with is a completely regular metric at R plus. So notice that R equals constant, just from this here, corresponds to UV equals constant, T equals constant, corresponds to U over V equals a constant. If R equals R plus, well, as R goes to R plus, R star goes to minus infinity. And so what that says, if I look at here, if R star goes to minus infinity, UV goes to zero. And then finally, as I send R to zero, that corresponds to UV is R plus squared. Sort of not as obvious in the way it's written. So if I sketch now what's going on, this is my V, this is my U, and out here, this part is my Schwarzschild patch. So in my Schwarzschild patch, these crystals here, U is negative and V is positive, right? My Schwarzschild patch. So that's this quadrant here. Now, T equals constant means U is proportional to V. So this line is T equals constant. And this line here is R equals constant. Now, R equals R plus is UV equals zero. So that's these axis lines. So that's kind of weird, because what started off as a single value of our R coordinate and what we would sort of visually perceive as a round ball, a black hole, suddenly sort of has this sort of more light cone structure here. Okay. So remember, sort of we've got an S2 over each point on this sketch. And then finally, see if I can find a nice glaring color. If I look at UV as R plus squared, I get a hyperbola in each of these quadrants. So this is R is zero. So now I just want to discuss again a bit more this picture. So I want to think about what happens as R equals R plus. So if I go to R plus at fixed T, fixed and finite T, then if I look again at my coordinates here, T is just some finite number. So I have both of these going like the most important behavior is e to the r star over 2r plus. And e to the r star is 2gm times stuff. So that means both u and v go to zero if t is fixed. So this point here is at r goes to r plus at fixed t. Now, let t go to infinity with t plus r star constant. So in other words, t and r star are going to, in modulus, are going to infinity at the same rate, then u tends to zero, but v is a constant, or some v is finite. So if you, this line is u equals zero, so this bit here is r tends to r plus with t going to infinity. And similarly, this line here is r tends to r plus, t tends to minus infinity.
Sorry, are the little calculations here left as an exercise, or because it was kind of hard for me to follow every single little condition here?
Yeah, so I mean, here there's nothing, you know, there's nothing kind of mysterious going on in the background here. So these are sort of, I think, you know, if these are sort of things that if you kind of sort of sit quietly, it won't take long to verify. So, I mean, I'm just really using the fact that r star tends to minus infinity as r tends to r plus, because r plus is 2gm. So you've got log of r minus r plus. And so log tends to minus infinity as r, you know, as the argument tends to zero. So, you know, this is sort of saying, well, okay, I know on the horizon my r star is becoming negative infinity, but how can I go to the horizon? Well, I can either go at constant t, and then if I go at constant t, this can't do anything. So both of these now, you're exponentiating the log of r minus r plus. So that's why it goes to zero. Both of them go to zero. But drawing, sketching u and v shows that there's this whole light cone type structure. And so I'm saying, well, how might I get here? Well, I can it's simultaneous to sending my r star to minus infinity, I can send my t either to plus infinity or minus infinity. And if I send it to plus infinity, I find that that corresponds to the u equals zero axis. If I send it to minus infinity, it corresponds to the v equals zero axis. And so you see that you access these different parts of the horizon via approaching the black hole along, I mean, one way is approaching it sort of along a light ray, right? So here, So u and v are null directions. You got them by exponentiating the t plus and minus r star, which are null directions. So they're maintaining what we call the causal structure of the space-time. And so typically, when we're drawing causal structure, we plot light rays at 45 degrees. So I just want to.
I understood what you said about these three conditions, but why is R0 the squiggly lines?
That's from the bottom hyperboloid, UV is R plus squared. So if UV is R plus squared, either U and V are both positive and it's a hyperbola, or U and V are both negative as a hyperbola. So just turn your head 45 degrees, essentially. Yeah. So let me just say that u equals 0, v greater than 0 is the future event horizon, and v equals 0, u less than 0 is the past event horizon. So although you will see this thing here is a sort of maximally extended solution. In reality, black holes form from collapse, so they're only going to have a future event horizon. But our exact solution can be extended beyond the event horizon, both to the future and to the past.
When R goes to 0, UV is R plus squared, and you say tilt your head 45 degrees.
Yeah, to get the hyperbola. Mm-hmm.
When R is constant, also UV is constant. So the condition is kind of like. But when you wanted to draw the R is equal to constant, it was another problem.
That's because that's this R goes to 0 is inside the event horizon, so it's outside the Schwarzschild patch. And I said, when I wrote it down, I said it's not sort of obvious from what I've written down, okay? You have to kind of analytically continue beyond the horizon. And then, you know, so I did comment that one wasn't that obvious. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, for the middle point, can the fixed t be specified or is it in the unit?
It's all of them, any t and finite t.
So can
you
specify the time?
Sorry?
So the time of the middle point cannot be
specified. It's any time. It's if it's a coordinate singularity. So it's like saying that the origin of the plane in polars can be any phi.
Yes.
Yeah, or all phi. Yeah. Any or all phi, yeah. So did you see Penrose diagrams, by the way, or did you derive them or see them? No. Okay. So now this picture is fine. It respects the causal structure, but it's infinite, right? U and V are in the reals. So this, by taking arctan, you squash an infinite range down into a finite range. And then V equals zero, for example, corresponds to P equals zero. And V is R plus, corresponds to P is pi by four, for example. UV equals R plus squared. So what this is an example actually of what's called a conformal transformation, which is where you change distances but not angles. And so if I look at what happens, my U and my V now come to a fixed range from minus pi on 2 to pi on 2. So I've got P and Q, and this is P is pi on 2. And then my singularity at R equals 0 corresponds to Q plus P equals pi on 2, or plus or minus pi on 2, should I say. And then my range cuts off a pi on 2, so I get that. And so this is what's known as a Penrose or Penrose-Carter diagram. So just to label some things here, this surface here, P is pi on 2, corresponds to V tends to infinity, and that is where outgoing null rays end up. So this is called future null infinity, or scry plus, so script I, scry plus. Similarly, Q is minus pi on 2 is where all of the ingoing rays come from, so that is past null infinity, or scry minus. So here, this is scry plus, scry minus. This I've lost the piece of chalk. So this one is I plus, and this one is I minus. So these are just labels. So this Penrose diagram encodes the causal structure of any particular space-time. So it's really just saying, you know, what are the important features of infinity? So, for example, when you do complex analysis, you tend to take the complex plane, which is an infinite R squared, but you tend to add a single point at infinity and make the Riemann sphere, for example. And that's what you do in complex analysis. Here, you're looking, you know, you've got, it's a bit more complicated because it's space-time with a Lorentzian structure. But here, because of that Lorentzian structure, because of the causal structure of space-time, you now have to identify different features of infinity. You can go to infinity along by just a sort of space-like geodesic, and that gives you space-like infinity. You can go to infinity by waiting forever, that's time-like infinity up at the top, or you can go to infinity by sending a light ray. Where does the light ray end up? Or where did it come from? And so you get all of these different potential features in infinity, in space-time. So Penrose diagrams are very useful. You'll see them a lot. But just to note that here I've suppressed the angular directions, just like I said before. So really, you can only draw a Penrose diagram on a piece of paper, two-dimensional, if you have some form of spherical or either spherical or angular symmetry, because you know, you need to be able to say that at each radius the same sort of thing is happening. So if it isn't, then you need to draw sort of three-dimensional Penrose diagrams. So I just wanted to finish off by noting what happens if you have a cosmological constant. So of course this was famously Einstein's biggest blunder, where he added a lambda. You can either write it as 8 pi g, if you like, 8 pi g tab as lambda gab. So in other words, it's like a source for the Einstein equations, but it's a source proportional to the metric. So if I have that source, notice if I look up here that GTT minus GRR is still zero. So I still have that relation in my area gauge. So let me now look at this integral here for b squared. Don't pick me up on my lack of constants. Yet. Okay. So this is kind of what I've got. So when I do my integral, I still get an integration constant. So I've still got my arbitrary constant, right? But now here I'm integrating my 4 pi's and the 2 g's cancel. I'm integrating lambda r squared. So I get lambda over 3 r cubed, but then I divide by r, so I end up with r squared. So that is a solution for, this is my black hole with a cosmological constant. So this is my Schwarzschild. We call it Schwarzschild either anti-de Sitter or Schwarzschild de Sitter. So my b squared, if this is 2gm, I either get something like this for positive lambda, or something like this for negative lambda. Now, there's just two main things that I want to say, sort of around having a cosmological constant. So for positive lambda, we usually say we have a de Sitter solution, except strictly de Sitter space. Strictly de Sitter is just pure empty, is empty de Sitter, so no black hole. But for positive lambda, you see that you potentially have two solutions. So you have two horizons, or none. And so you have one, you know, one horizon which is near 2GM. If 2GM is small, so that's your black hole. And then you have another horizon which is roughly root 3 on lambda, which we call L, and that is a cosmological horizon. But there is an upper limit on the mass of a black hole in de Sitter space, and you can see that really intuitively by thinking, well, when lambda is positive, I get a cosmological horizon. So there's a limit to how much black hole I can squeeze inside that cosmological horizon. So this is a feature of de Sitter. And this is called the Nariai limit. And the other thing I just wanted to note is for de Sitter, there are many coordinate patches. So we have a static patch. You'll also see in cosmology. A global patch. And then the most relevant one for inflationary cosmology, flat, FRW. And in fact, de Sitter can be represented by a sort of embedding space by just embedding a hyperboloid in R5. So this ends up being the hyperboloid.
Can you explain again where the limit comes from?
Sorry, the limit. So physically, because you have a cosmological horizon, you can't squeeze to, you know, there's a limit to the size of a black hole you can put inside. Mathematically, you see that if for a fixed lambda, this is a cubic, so it has at most three real roots. There's one, always one at negative r. So either you have two roots, or if you try to increase m, that goes down, and eventually you have no roots. So that's mathematically how you see it. if lambda is less than zero, this is your sort of famous anti-de Sitter situation, and now can have a planar hyperbolic as well as spherical black hole. So for anti-de Sitter, your a squared ads, you've got the s squared is a squared dt squared minus the r squared on a squared minus r squared. And now you have this, which could be, so if I put that as kappa, it could be flat, spherical, or hyperboloid. And this corresponds to an a squared is kappa minus 2gm on r minus lambda on 3 r squared. But this is like plus r squared on l squared. So because your cosmological constant now gives a positive contribution to that potential, you see that you can kind of, you don't have to have that one. And that one was there because you had a two sphere. You had an SO3 symmetry. So I'm going to stop there. That was very, very quick for ADS, but I think there might be a tutorial on ADS anyway. So, yes.
How did you do the second line and the third line here?
Here?
The metric, yes. And when you said M is equal to zero?
So that's saying if there's no black hole, so you have pure de Sitter space, just a lambda, then there are many ways of writing the geometry of de Sitter space. So de Sitter space is actually that hyperboloid embedded in five-dimensional flat space, but I can coordinatize it in a load of different ways. It's got a lot of symmetry.
But these are the different ways that you can write them?
Yeah, it's exactly the same geometry, but it's written in different coordinate patches. The only one that covers the whole of de Sitter is the middle one. So I think that the static patch is kind of taking a sort of slice down the hyperboloid, and I think the flat FRW takes a sort of a cut through it. So they each cover different parts of de Sitter. Just like the Schwarzschild coordinate patch only covers, in some sense, a quarter of the Schwarzschild solution.
You said when you wanted to find the Nariani limit, is
mm-hmm. Nariani? Yeah. Uh-huh.
You see when I think when that when lambda is positive,
mm-hmm.
when that plot intersects the horizontal axis.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens, that the b inverse squared goes to zero.
Yeah.
That also is derivative.
So it's a very special point because it looks as if you've kind of lost your space in a way, because B is now just, it's either negative or zero, right? So it looks like you've kind of, it's disappeared. But in fact, you can, in essence, do a coordinate transformation that kind of blows it up. But you sort of end up with this two-sphere crossed with a sort of flat space.
You're saying for that limit to that limit shows how massive a black hole you could have in your space when lambda is positive.
Mm-hmm.
But if lambda is positive enough, let's say it's infinity or something.
As lambda gets bigger, you can get bigger and bigger black holes. Yeah.
Can you?
The other way around. Sorry, I keep getting mixed up with lambda and L. Yeah, sorry, you're right. Yeah, as lambda gets smaller, you can get bigger and bigger black holes.
But lambda is bigger.
Bigger.
At some point, you can't have anything in your space.
Well, it would have to be infinite to have nothing at all in your space,
yeah.
But you don't want to go above the Planck scale.
Okay, but if it was the Planck scale, what can you have?
I would say you don't know what you can have. So, because we shouldn't really be using general relativity at the, you know, right up at the Planck scale. So, yeah. I'm going to leave you to ponder that while I take another question.
There are two things which always confuse me. So mm-hmm. One of them is the Sitter space is related to lambda being positive. But the other big picture is that of D Sitter signature, which is like 2, 2 split signature.
That's okay. That's not.
Good question.
That's not.
Not this. No. No.
You can embed, because
ADS
to be embedded in.
Oh, ADS is different. Yes, ADS you can embed in 2-time. Yeah, but ADS is it's a lot more you know, mind bending than DS. DS is very sort of straightforward to have different ways of visualizing. ADS just come in. ADS is a bit a bit difficult.
Why doesn't b squared being equal to negative exist? Because everywhere we had b squared, I think you just defined it as b squared. So you might as well start it with a.
But if you change the sign of b squared, then r becomes a time-like coordinate. Also, you know, so you're flipping the meaning of r and t. And so that means it's taking you into a different metric. It's one of the reasons, actually, when we do Schwarzschild, we kind of get lazy and we still sort of think of R and T inside the horizon, because if you just flip the sign of B and B squared and A squared at the same time, you've still got the right signature. Yeah, yeah. But R is now a time-like coordinate, right?
Yeah.
And so that means as you go forward in time, you're going right into the crunch at r equals zero.
Yeah.
So, but from a physical perspective, we want r to be telling us about the area of spheres around our black hole, and that's a spatial statement.
But if you're
there's another reason, that's cosmic censorship. We don't want a naked singularity. So,
but I think if you have big enough of a lambda, that becomes negative, and so the sign of the two components of the metric change. So one of them, so the
yeah, it's not just about signature; it's about the physics of it as well. So this is your Penrose for Schwarzschild de Sitter, right? But that's where you have a horizon, okay? As soon as you kind of get rid of that horizon, what I think you'll have, but I'd have to just think about it a bit more, so apologies if this isn't correct, I think you'd have that, and that's a naked singularity.
So we'll get a naked singularity when...
If you don't have a horizon, you have a naked singularity for these things, because r equals zero is now time-like, right? And you don't have a horizon to protect yourself from it, which means you have something like that. So you lose predictability, and so we don't want that. Okay, this not allowing no horizons is based sort of in having a physical theory.
Mm-hmm.